Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
I'm thrilled to be talking today with Ellen Moore, author of Grateful Nation, Student Veterans, and the Rise of the Military-Friendly Campus, published by Duke University Press in 2017. Dr. Moore, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Could you begin by telling us a bit about yourself, where you were born, went to school, sort of your life outside of this one book?
Sure. I was born on the Army base. At the time, it was called Fort Lewis. Now it's Fort Lewis McChord outside of Seattle, actually in Tacoma, Washington. My father was in the Army at the time, and so I was born on an Army base, and then the early years of my life were spent on different Army bases around the country as my father got transferred to different places. But I spent most of my time growing up in the North Bay, in the Bay Area, in Northern California. So that was my sort of early schooling and growing up. I went to different colleges. College didn't really stick for me until the end. I went to like three different colleges. I went for a while to University of California at Berkeley as an undergrad, went for a while to a college in Washington State as an undergrad, and finally finished my undergrad education at San Francisco State University. I then went on to have a career in social work. I went back to school to UC Berkeley to get my doctorate in social and cultural studies of education, which leads us to where we are. Oh, my other life outside of the book, I have two daughters, one in college right now and one in high school. And I have a husband and we live in the Bay Area.
Okay, well, thank you. And let's talk about the book now, Grateful Nation. How did you get the initial idea for this book?
Well, when I was researching different ways people learn as a doctoral student in education, and I was going to events on campus, and here I heard this alarming statistic that said that 96% of all veterans, military enlistees, sign up for the GI Bill, and of those, less than 8% were using their benefits. And I was extremely alarmed by this statistic. On its face, it seemed quite unjust that I knew that many people, my own father included, signed up for, enlisted in the military in part for educational benefits. And the fact that they weren't able to use those was deeply disturbing to me. And as a student of education and anthropology, I wanted to find out why that was. What was getting in the way of returned veterans not being able to access their GI Bill benefits and not being able to graduate? So I was concerned about that. So that's what I started out doing in this. What I started out to do was to think about what might get in the way. And my first hypothesis was perhaps it was the difference in training. So the first part of my research was on military training and trying to understand how people learn as they learn to become military members, not just combatants, but members of a military corpus. So that's what I was looking at in the beginning. And then I was looking at their experience on college campuses and what would help them succeed on campus and what might impede their progress.
And so what did your research for the book entail?
I started out by just doing ethnographic observation. I chose two different campuses. One was a community college in rural California and one was a research university in urban California. And I thought that both of those sites would give me insight into the very different circumstances that student veterans found themselves in. So I was looking at different sites and spending a lot of time on campus, observing classes, observing public events on campus, and then having in-depth interviews that often were up to 4 hours long. I mean, with breaks and with the consent of the interviewees, but we just had these really long conversations, interviews, semi-structured interviews that turned into just long ethnographic conversations.
And then once you've gathered all of that material, how do you start? What does the writing process look like for you?
Well, because I consider the heart of this book and the heart of my research to be the interviews with the veterans, I sort of started there. I started with what they were telling me about their experience in the military and their experience on college campuses. So in that sense, I think that there's some grounded theory methodology involved in this because I started out studying one thing and ended up with another focus, an additional focus. So my process was to do these very, very in-depth interviews, sometimes over the course of several days, and then transcribing the interviews. I started out doing that myself, which was incredibly time-consuming, but also incredibly fruitful because I got to really engage again with the material. And it transcribing the interviews myself is both, well, it's at once, it's intimate because you're really, really hearing the words, you're hearing the inflections, you're hearing different things than you experienced during the live interview. But at the same time, it's very tedious and time consuming. So, but with that process, starting out with that, with the transcription and the revisiting those conversations, I was really able to kind of hear beyond what they were saying, but also hear their inflections, hear the affect that was coming through. Often it was really clear, this affect of either pain or anger. So I would transcribe the interviews, go over the data, and see patterns that emerge from that. For example, when I was hearing one of the explanations in the beginning about veterans' challenges on campuses, I kept hearing this explanation of that college campuses were anti-military, and there was somehow this anti-military sentiment that was off-putting to veterans or actively pushing them off campus. That was created a sort of disconnect for me because I was not observing that at any of the campuses that I visited. I did in-depth research on two campuses, but then visited many more campuses at 7-8 other campuses that I went specifically to examine this. And I wasn't finding that college campuses were anti-military. I was actually finding the opposite, that veterans were actively welcomed on campus or sort of ignored or seen as just students. So not maliciously ignored, but sort of benignly ignored. So that was the process when I was talking to veterans and sort of trying to square what they said with my own observations and what I was reading in the printed literature. Through that process, I kind of came up with this other analysis about what I think is getting in the way of veterans' success on campus.
And then just because I'm always interested in this, just so we can picture it, when you're sitting down to write this book, where are you? Are you at the kitchen table, in an office, a coffee shop? Like where do you do your writing for the book?
So I was very fortunate to be a fellow at what's called the Slow Science Institute. It's a group of scholars started by the educational anthropologist Jean Lave. It's a group, it's an office, or it takes place in a loft, and we all gather from different disciplines, social scientists from different disciplines, and we have projects, scholarly projects that we're working on. So we're in this big loft, we each have a desk, we each have a computer, and we work on our individual projects pretty much in silence. I'm not one of those people that can write in a, with background ambient noise. So we work in silence, but we work together. We're all together. And then we stop at lunchtime. And those of us that can take a break in our work, join in at like a communal lunch. So we talk about our ideas, we discuss our different projects, we ask each other questions and get feedback on our work, and then we go back to work in the afternoon. So that was the first, after I completed my research, that's where I went to do the initial writing. Towards the end, I had other jobs that kind of got in the way of that process, and then I just wrote at the kitchen table. Then I did, you know, or I did weekend writing. But the bulk of the book was written at the Slow Science Institute.
Wow, that Slow Science Institute sounds ideal. It sounds so much more civilized and communal than my experience of the writing process usually is.
I think it's definitely, it's a move towards more kind of human, scholarly, slow thinking, you know, and deep analysis. It's a conscious effort.
That's wonderful.
To create deep analysis at interdisciplinary and collegial.
Well, now let's turn to the book itself. So part of your argument is that American society today is deeply militarized, and not just in broad economic and political terms, but in our everyday domestic social worlds as well. And I wondered if you could sort of explain that for our listeners.
Sure. I think that militarization happens not just during times of war, but we actually are in a war. In several wars right now, this country is involved in around the globe. But militarization happens in sort of daily, can happen in daily interactions and daily messages that we receive, or daily icons that we're taught to read. Let me see how I can explain this better. We're used to thinking, I think, in this country of ourselves as a power. A superpower. We are a superpower, and but the way that we, I'm going to stop here for a second, okay, and hopefully we can edit this out. Okay, so militarization of everyday life just means that we understand the military's place in the United States as sort of a naturalized part. And we have come to, I think, understand the use of force throughout the world as a naturalized process in this country. So if we are sending arms to Yemen, or if we are somehow encouraging military strikes anywhere or participating in military strikes anywhere, that's seen as a natural and necessary part of being a nation. And I think that is a pretty new understanding for us, that it's not, in times past, when the United States has actively been involved in military conflicts, there, at other times in the country, there has been more discussion, more public discussion. One example is, well, in World War II, there was a national effort to support the war, but people were actively involved in that, actively involved in thinking about what was going on, actively debating what we do as a country and why we were there, rationales for that. Different conflicts have different either social support or social levels of social discourse around it. During the Vietnam War, as we know, it was a highly contested conflict. So there were people that really did not agree with the U.S. participation in the war or the rationale for the war. And there were people that really did agree with that. But there was a debate. I mean, people were talking about this. What I find now with the current conflicts is that there is not much debate. I mean, it's just taken as a given that the United States needs to be involved in armed conflicts throughout the world. And that is a different situation. That is different than any other time in history. And I argue in the book that part of what enables that naturalization of military processes is an absence of discussion about the wars and about the U.S. military role in the world. And I further argue that that absence of discussion, or that silencing of discussion, is enabled by a discourse or an understanding that war veterans or military veterans in our society need to require this silence about the wars, because to voice dissent about the wars would be interpreted by the veterans themselves as disrespect towards their service and towards their sacrifice. So it's a fairly complicated argument that I make, but that's what it is, basically, in a nutshell, that there is a silence about the current wars and a naturalization of military involvement throughout the world that is enabled by an understanding that to talk critically about the wars or to examine the rationale of the wars is to disrespect the veterans, to conflate the interests of the veterans with the interest of the U.S. military, and to enable a silence about talking about the wars.
Well, and you note this really interesting paradox that civilian life has become increasingly militarized, even as the numbers of soldiers and veterans declines, as fewer and fewer Americans actually have a personal connection to the military as an institution.
That's true. That is absolutely true. One of the ways that this sort of silence is enabled is the fact that with the voluntary with the lack of conscription, I mean, when the draft was abolished and it became a choice to join the military or not, some would say it's a coerced choice, but there was no conscription, and so fewer and fewer people were opting into the military, opting to serve. And so there was there is a big disconnect. Less than 1% of people sign up for the military in this country. And so fewer people are actually engaged in this institution and in the practices of military power. And yet there is a divide that people are feeling like they're not personally connected to the military. And yet there is an idea that, and I believe that there is a growing militarization in absentia, sort of, we're not participating with hands-on or personal understanding of it, but we are, we're relying on messages coming to us about veterans and about the military, absent a personal connection to it.
To help the reader understand how we got to this contemporary point in terms of the experience of students, veterans that you document in your book, you offer a brief history of veterans and higher education. And I wondered if you could give us a quick overview of that.
Sure. What's commonly known as the GI Bill started out after World War II, when there was a recognition that veterans coming home from, military members coming home from war, needed and deserved some help to reenter society. And so it came at the end of the sort of New Deal understanding, or as part of the New Deal consciousness, that the government should and could support people, you know, sort of to have a good start in life, and that there was a place for the public sector to support people in terms of housing, in terms of education, in terms of bank loans, things like that. So there was this understanding, it was sort of a Keynesian understanding, that the government did have a crucial role, the public sector did have a crucial role in supporting people as they came. And so the veterans, the GI Bill was had to do with housing loans, that veterans could come back and get low interest housing loans. They had more access to education. They had access to free education. And college education, and that was responsible for some of the largest numbers of veterans going to college. It enabled veterans to go to college and then to complete college. There was a lot of support for that, and there was public support for this idea that is a legitimate role of the government to help people who wouldn't otherwise have a chance to go to college. It was sort of seen as a very equalizing role of the government to play, democratizing role. And so that was an important first template of what the government could do to help veterans get an education, a college education. So following that, there were different iterations after the Vietnam War. When veterans came back from the Vietnam War, there was not a similar consensus that the U.S. government, I mean, there was, let me try to think of a good way to say this. Well, veterans coming back from the Vietnam War were not received with the same kind of consensus of approbation from the general population as World War II veterans, I can say that. And also the idea of the Great Society had sort of waned. I mean, the idea that this was an appropriate role for government to subsidize or wholly or partially subsidize social services for people was becoming out of favor And so with that, the GI Bill became less robust, became sort of eroded after the Vietnam War. So Vietnam veterans had fewer resources devoted to them, as did the World War II veterans. So there's been changes in the GI Bill itself, but what didn't change was this idea that veterans deserved some extra help, you know, in terms of education, housing, when they returned from war. A big difference in this was that after the Vietnam War, conscription was abolished, and so education and the GI Bill became an recruitment incentive. So to get people to join the military, that was, recruiters definitely talked a lot about college education, and there became an idea that this was the bargain, that you go to war, you sign up to go to war, you sign up to join the military to get an education. So that is a crucial part of the starting point of this book, is that over time, the GI Bill has become less of an entitlement and more of a recruitment signing bonus. And so when that's how the GI Bill was used in many, many recruitment efforts, it seemed like an incredible injustice that veterans weren't actually able to make good on that promise when they got back.
Well, and in your book, when you turn to the experiences of these student veterans today, you do an interesting thing. I like how you sort of start at the individual level and then move out. So in the first chapter, you start with that individual process of going through basic training. So I thought, maybe could you speak a bit to how basic training goes about turning civilians into soldiers?
And I just want to say, the reason that I started that way is because that follows my research process. I had thought that at first I would look at training to become a military member and then the supposed untraining, or the training to become a student after that. So I was looking at those individual processes. And in the course of studying that, I saw these social processes, the larger scale processes happening. And so the path of the book follows the path of my research, going from the individual to the social process. I just had to say that. So when I looked at how civilians become soldiers, I studied basic training as the core experience, because that is the point at which it's decided there is a process to untrain the civilian, or to take the civilian out of their habitus or how they have been living, and consciously place them in a corpus and train them to be in a corpus and to act in concert with other people, to conceptualize themselves as a person involved in a mission, and mission supersedes the idea of individuality and individual. There are very specific processes that are involved in basically untraining the civilian and creating the soldier identity and the soldiering practices, or military practices. So I was looking at basic training, and I had to rely on the veterans themselves. They were pretty recently separated from the military, so recently discharged. So I think that the memories were fairly fresh. But I found that the memories, even if with time, they were indelible. I mean, this was a period of life for most of the people I spoke with that was indelible. It was embodied. It was hard won. It was the lessons of basic training I found were, by and large, very difficult, very, in some cases, traumatic, but in all cases, endured. The lessons of basic training endured in one way or another, either by the way they structured the veterans and the students' subsequent lives and identities, or through the rejection of that. I mean, I saw both of those things. They were an embodied, intensely embodied experience, and intensely consequential for the student veterans. So I started the first chapter by looking at those processes. What happens? How do people become trained in a completely different way of thinking and acting, and what psychologically and sort of physically, what effects does that have on people as they go through that training process?
Well, and then you go on to talk about how when veterans arrive on college and university campuses, their experiences that you describe in military training and combat conflict, in some ways, those things conflict with what is expected of them in academic life. And that can be part of what makes for a difficult transition. Can you give us some examples of how this works?
Absolutely. They do sometimes. So the way that people are trained in basic training and in military practice, basic training sort of lays the template for behaviors and identities. And then throughout their military service, it's reinforced for a much longer period of time. So it becomes kind of ingrained. As one veteran said, it becomes a mindset, and then it becomes a lifestyle. So, in his mind, what he was talking about was he learned certain ways to act and also certain ways to respond affectively and respond emotionally and psychologically to ideas of threat and ideas of the unknown. So I will be more specific. In basic training, one of the processes that is used is sort of, I would say, brute punishment for individual infractions. And, you know, there's a certain amount of physical consequences to mistakes or a learning curve mistake. For example, if one makes a mistake with either uniform or not getting the lock on the locker done right, the whole platoon or the whole squad can be subject to what's called smokings, or, you know, doing push-ups. You know, 100 push-ups, hundreds of push-ups. So the group punishment for individual infractions becomes definitely a psychological threat to people. I mean, people are on the lookout for that. That becomes a difficult learning process that people hold on to. So there is a lot of embodied kind of reward and punishment system in military training, and when people get to the university, this idea of hierarchy is still there, but I argue it's much more covert in the university. There's a very strict rank system in the military that there's punishments attached to not adhering to the strict rank structure. Addressing somebody by the incorrect title can result in punishment. Not wearing the uniform correctly results in punishment. So there's a lot of very strict rules that are enforced strongly and consistently. And then when people come to the university, people are rewarded for almost the opposite. They're rewarded for independent thought. They're rewarded for questioning authority. People are I'm making a broad generalization. I am talking about the institutions that I observe, but there is a sort of overall sort of different way of thinking about the world, that critique is seen as a good thing or something that can propel conversation and propel theory forward, with critique of the old. And so a lot of vets come to campus really trained in not just following orders, but not stepping out of line. Flying under the radar is what people told me a lot. You know, you don't distinguish yourself, because if you distinguish yourself negatively, you get punished. If you distinguish yourself positively, you get punished as a reward, as a quote unquote reward, because you get more duties put on you. If you distinguish yourself, if you show yourself to be super competent, then you get more duties. So there's this sort of idea that you do what you're told to do, and you do it well, and you do it honorably, but you do it what you're told to do. So that's the message that I got from many of the vets, that they learned how to do this, you know, under duress. And so coming to college campuses, when the rules were not written, I mean, that's one thing about the military, is that they give you rule books. They tell you what is expected, and there's not a lot of sort of finding your way and trial and error, and you decide what works for yourself. And I would argue that on many college campuses, that's the default position, is that you are there to sort of learn, but nobody really tells you what is expected. You're sort of supposed to know this. And it works much better for students in the university that are coming from college prep, high schools and even elementary schools, that there's a way of learning that is individually driven and intrinsically motivated. And so I think that those things are taught as well, but they're not acknowledged as much. So there can be a disconnect of of learning styles when people get, and learning histories when people get to the university. A specific example can be, there's a someone who I call Cody, who returned from Iraq. He did a tour of Iraq. He was in the Navy, but he was in the he was assigned in Iraq to guard a camp, a prison camp. And so one of the lessons that he learned that was in no rule book or in no curriculum was that he should mistrust everybody, and that at any point, anybody could become the enemy and anybody could become a lethal threat. And that was one of the lessons that he learned in war, is, and especially in a counterinsurgency war and in a war where one didn't know who the enemy was. So when Cody came back to his community college in California, that the college classroom for him became a very threatening place. He didn't know who these people were that were sitting next to him in class. He was hypervigilant. He was constantly on the alert for attack coming from anywhere, any unknown quarters. So he was clearly experiencing post-traumatic stress symptoms in the classroom. He had been trained to always be on guard against lethal attack, and he couldn't. I mean, he asked me, "How do you untrain that? How do you get rid of that?" And I think that's a really excellent question that we all have to ask ourselves if we're going to send people to wartime, to combat situations. So for Cody, it was really difficult. He was flooded. He became flooded with sensory input. He was always trying to see who was behind him, who was in front of him, who might be a threat. He was evaluating, you know, he was always had a hierarchy of threat going on in his head. He would see a petite female in the class and figure that they wouldn't be as threatening, but he would see, you know, he just had his own hierarchy of threat, who he considered to be a potential lethal threat. So that was going on in his mind all the time, and it made him very difficult for him to function in the classroom. And he just became overwhelmed with feelings of his own failure. I mean, he's a very bright young man. He knew he was a bright young man. He joined the military so he could have money for college, and then he was in college and he was not able to function, and that was extremely frustrating for him. And I want to say that many of these stories that I have in the book, I would love to do a follow-up on all of them, because these are challenges, but they're not determinative challenges. For example, Cody, through sticking it out and through having to drop out for a time and having to find a way to communicate with his professors and let them know what was going on, which was also difficult for him. But through proper support and through understanding that this was a new phase of his life, and through psychological help, he's now on his way to going to med school. That's what he wants to do. He wants to be a doctor. And so the cautionary tale that I put out in the book is a partial tale. It is a moment in time. And I found that many of the student veterans that I talked to are still finding their way in the university or college and are still proceeding with their plans. And so while I paint a picture that is, I think, is their experience in that moment, it's not determining ultimately of their success or failure.
Book really demonstrates that many colleges and universities are aware of some of these challenges, maybe not the exact nature of them, but they're certainly cognizant of the fact that student veterans might need additional or different kinds of support than non-veteran students do. And so one of the things you do in your book is you look at the veteran support services that are offered on two different college campuses and sort of look at what's offered and also how it's offered. So could you tell us a bit about what do these support services tend to look like? What kinds of programs and support tend to be offered?
Sure. So, and veteran support services is a constantly evolving field. And I should say that when I started this research at one of the campuses in 2010 or 2009, 2010, there was nothing on campus. And so that was the picture that I saw then. By the time I did my last visit there, I think in 2013, they had a veterans club, they had a veterans space on campus. It evolved it's evolving, you know, fairly rapidly, I would say. I think some are arguing that it's going backwards now, that it's not in the public consciousness, that the amount of support is decreasing. But what I found in my period of research is that there was consciousness building around the needs of veterans. And so different campuses were increasing their services and adapting their services. What I found on the different campuses is that often veteran support was framed in a way that implied a certain ideology, or there were certain ideological or philosophical underpinnings that about veteran support, some common sense understandings. For example, that veteran support services built on positive identifications with the military would be more effective than veteran support services that didn't automatically include positive valoration of the military institution. So I found that debate going on a lot. It wasn't so much a debate as it was an assumption that to have effective veteran support services, one had to develop them around a positive identification with the military institutions. And that assumed a unitary understanding of what being a military member meant. So and what I found in my research is that they're very highly differing understandings of the military institution and people's experience in the military institutions. And people had very different levels of affiliation and identification with the military. Some student veterans wanted to leave all of that behind. They disagreed with the military mission. They felt a certain amount of regret and remorse about what they did during the wars. Some felt that they really wanted to be identified with the military and were proud of that and wanted to be honored for that on campus. So there was a very different levels of affiliation and identification felt by the veterans. But most of the services were built around the assumption that all veterans positively identified with their military experience. And so to best serve them, one needed to suture a positive military narrative with the student veterans' needs. And I found that didn't work all the time. I mean, it didn't. Student veterans told me privately that it was alienating for some of them. They didn't want to be on campus as representatives of the U.S. military or of the U.S. military projects or conflicts abroad. They wanted actively to distance themselves for that. So that was something that I found, you know, in no way did it speak to, I think, bad motives on the part of service providers. And that's something that I feel like I always want to say, is that the service providers that I met on campuses were uniform in their wanting to help veterans. So that the impulse to help veterans and the desire to help veterans and help them succeed on campus was always there. It was just the way that these services were conceived and carried out that were sometimes problematic for the veterans themselves. And I think that service providers didn't often look at those the services critically to understand what might be helpful and what might be harmful.
And I thought one of the interesting examples that you discuss about that is, for example, the prohibition on political speech at meetings and events for veterans. Right? There was sort of a narrative that we don't talk politics here. But you point out, based on your observations, that was actually selectively enforced. So if a veteran wanted to celebrate a battle that the U.S. had just won, then that was fine. But if a student veteran wanted to question whether a war was justified or to be more critical of the military, then that was shut down as unwelcome, quote, political talk. And I can imagine that created a difficult space for student veterans who wanted to be able to speak and to listen to conversations like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Political speech was defined as talk that, you know, might critique the wars or critique their role in the military. So that was seen as political speech. And otherwise, you know, talking about a certain battle or celebrating certain weaponry, that was not considered political. That was considered life. And that's an example of the militarization of daily life. That's an example of just naturalization of speech, that to talk about, to critique a military conflict is considered political, to raffle off, for example, a semi-automatic weapon at a Marine's ball is not considered political. So that was very much in evidence in the services on college campuses that there was a regulation of speech, not from the university itself, but it was sort of fostered in the sort of valorization of military ideology. It was normalized and accepted, and the students themselves, many of them that really were aligned with some of the veterans clubs, took that up, took that identity up, and took that understanding that this was their place on campus to be representatives of the military and to foster that military identification, and the understanding that that would help student veterans succeed on campuses if there was a strong military identified group that consistently proposed those things. And along with it, that would help student veterans. And I found that not to be the case uniformly, not to be the case in all times for all veterans. There is the idea that I know that military members are told that they are not political people. They are just supposed to follow orders and do the job that their superiors tell them to do. So there is a kind of inculcated idea, no, we're not political. But the lack of sort of understanding and expanding what the implications of speech and actions are, that there are political implications to things. And the sort of shutting down of that kind of critical examination is what created a disconnect for many veterans, student veterans on campus. And I would argue veterans in the broader society as well.
Well, and you describe interesting ways that this moves beyond just the spaces of veteran support services, these different ways that you show how the idea of supporting student veterans has become conflated with uncritical support for the military as an institution. And I was especially struck by your description of a sensitivity training session you attended that was intended to educate community college instructors on how to better teach and support student veterans. And you described that during the training, instructors were taught to identify different kinds of weaponry, whether rocket-propelled grenade launchers or M16 automatic rifles, and to distinguish between the battle cries of the Army and Marines. And then were then divided into groups to practice those battle cries. And as I'm reading that as an educator, I just couldn't figure out how exactly that could possibly make an instructor a more effective or empathetic teacher. The two things, there didn't seem to be a direct connection between them for me. And I was curious how it came to be that supporting veterans started to mean celebrating the military itself as an institution.
You know, I think that I can't fully answer that question because that wasn't exactly my study. But what I did observe is that there were some early few representatives of military veterans on campuses that were sought out to lay out a template. And what I saw was that this idea that sensitivity to veterans' issues was sutured to, you know, learning the outward accoutrement of military life and valorizing the outward accoutrement of military life and sort of, I would argue, the mystification of military life, that to know, to distinguish an RPG, you know, rocket launcher or grenade launcher versus a semi-automatic rifle, that does not sensitize us to the daily realities and the needs of veterans. So how did this happen? I think it's because some people early on were looked to design services, and perhaps that's what they thought would be, maybe that's what they felt would help them learn. And so that was what was developed as the kind of training to do. And that became considered best practice, and that was disseminated throughout the country. So there is a template of best practices that includes these kind of sensitivity trainings. If I were to design sensitivity trainings, you know, with my experience as both a therapist and also just a social worker in the world, I would start out with finding out people's experience and how they viewed these institutions of the military and how they viewed their experience in the military to really assess what would help them, rather than assuming that valorizing practices and valorizing weaponry and learning the weaponry would sensitize people to being able to teach veterans, because they're very different endeavors, sort of surviving combat and participating in combat, or even participating in non-combat military institutions is very different than participating in college life. So I think they're two very different endeavors. And I think to conflate them into one go-to practice, which is, or one so-called best practice template, is partial and not the most valuable thing. So I'm only assuming that the way it developed that way was through listening to certain voices. I have to say that it dovetailed with certain interests, I would say, of the institutional military and the institutional state. So it does have some side effects of unquestioning support for the military. So while I don't know if that was the reason that these, I would not think that these, that is the reason that these, I don't have this conspiracy in my mind that, the Department of Defense said, we're going to develop services like this because that will not have people talk about the wars. I don't think that that's what happened, but I do think that there was a situation where people were looking to veterans, to some veterans, to talk about what they think would be useful. And so that became the best practice, but it happened to exclude the experience of many, many others. And it also happened to, so this kind of way of valorizing the military and conflating military interests with student veteran interests happened to coincide with a project of valorizing the military in general in our society. So that was a side effect. I think it was a side effect rather than an intent from the beginning to develop these services, but that is I still think it's the same outcome, that we conflate student veterans' needs are conflated with the institutional military's needs.
Well, you also go on to describe how, in addition to drawing on these organized resources that are provided on campus, students also forge their own diverse and creative strategies to adapt to post-military life as college students. And I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about some of those strategies that the student veterans themselves created.
Sure. I mean, I think one of the initiatives that happens often, either generated by students themselves or generated by the school, are the creation of veterans clubs. And having a veterans club, a space where veterans can come, I think is a really great idea, because often it allows veterans to develop their own needs or identify their own needs and their own services. So that is a sort of a uniform, it's not a uniform, but it's a typical move on college campuses to develop those spaces for veterans. And I think that's great. I think that many veterans on campuses where there's not a huge apparatus of support just by necessity seek out other veterans and offer support. One thing that I found across campuses was that there was a strong sense among many student veterans of wanting to support each other. So that is something that I think held over from their military training, to think of themselves as a body of people or of a group of people, and to maybe minimize the individual over the group. I saw that again and again, that even people that felt alienated from the campus veterans clubs because they felt like it was too much of a military valence would develop systems to help their own systems to help veterans identify what the GI Bill meant to them and what they could spend and what they needed to do. So I saw incredible efforts, either individually or on campus, to help each other, that to develop home cooked dinners, invite any veteran to come over for home cooked dinners, to come to veterans club meetings just when there was a crisis on campus, just to support their fellow veterans, even if they weren't regular members of the club. They just would say, I know my brothers and sisters are suffering. I want to be here for them. So whenever there was, something, if there was, sadly, we know that the suicide rate among combat veterans is extremely high, both on the battlefield and off. And if that happened on campus, and it did happen on campuses, but veterans would come and to offer support, whether or not they agreed with most of the people in the club, it didn't matter in that moment. It was just, I want to be here to support my brothers and sisters. So that was profoundly moving. And I saw that come up in diverse ways, whether it was having a night that was offered a home cooked meal to people that didn't have families on campus, just to come and share informally, or different kinds of social events to do. So I saw that really strongly, that there was that kind of support, whether or not it was sanctioned by the university, whether or not it was perceived of as a veteran support. It was offered individually and created by other people. I saw that women on campuses who are veterans often would develop their own internal support services, because they tended not to be reflected in the official campus veteran discourse. There was a lot of gender differences I found, and many women on campus felt kind of alienated from that, or didn't feel like it was their space. So they often wouldn't affiliate with the campus veterans clubs that tended to be male, dominated by males.
And I wanted to ask a little bit more about that. I was curious, what were some of the other ways that you saw that student veterans' experiences of college life, or the strategies they use to navigate through college life, how did those differ by gender or by race or other sorts of differences within the group of student veterans?
Well, I think when services are developed based on an idea, based on an imaginary or an idea of what veterans are, who veterans are, or what veterans want, that's going to create a set of services that caters to that imaginary or that idea of it. So, for example, if student veterans are conceived of as normatively male and sort of interested in, have positive associations with the military, there's going to be some services that are developed around that, that highlight the positive associations with the military, and that reinforce those sort of military bonds, or the bonds that were made in the military, maybe going out, organizing events to go out on the shooting range and shoot. And it doesn't mean that women don't like to shoot. I mean, there's many people, you know, like to shoot and like to do these different things, but not all of them. So there would be outings organized, tailgate parties, you know, shooting range expeditions. Whereas, you know, that was interesting to some, but it wasn't interesting to all. And by often the women that I spoke to, an interesting thing is that while my study and my semi-structured interviews started out always with their experience in the classroom, if veterans offered other information or started talking about something else, I would follow that line of questioning, and I would ask follow-up questions. And for the women, almost always, within 10 or 15 minutes, the conversation came to some kind of sexual harassment or sometimes sexual assault that happened to them in the military. So that experience of sexual harassment, sometimes sexual assault, was very present for many of the women, or at least being treated differentially and treated worse, treated as inferior. That theme came up again and again in my interviews with women, you know, without necessarily a particular rancor towards the military, but just that this was part of their experience. For some, it was incredibly onerous and difficult, and they did talk with that valence. But for many, it was just the fact of life in military, the way people are trained in the military to see feminine as weaker, as a threat. And so it was just sort of assumed as a part of military life. But when people got out of the military and wanted sort of to rearrange that social hierarchy, sometimes the organized veterans clubs were not as open to that rearrangement of the social hierarchy, and women felt excluded in that way, in terms of the activities that were chosen, in terms of the language that was used in the meetings, in terms of the space for different ideas and different priorities offered. So what I found was that many women would find other outside sources of support. There are non-affiliated veteran support services in San Francisco and in the Bay Area that women would gravitate to. And to their credit, those non-affiliated support services did develop specific support groups for women who have experienced military sexual trauma, what's known as MST, sexual harassment or assault, more specifically sexual assault in the military. And so there were spaces created for those kind of discussions that were not, I would say, by and large, not welcome in the veterans clubs.
And were there any other differences within veterans' experience, perhaps based on conflicts in which they served, or age, or race, or the sorts of educations they were pursuing in college?
There were, for sure. I'm trying to answer that question. Yes, absolutely, there were. People had different reasons, motivations for going, and, you know, including wanting to having an understanding that they were defending the country against enemies that. And so that they had to go to these conflicts. So there were very different motivations for joining. One of the threads, because I studied sort of a subset, I studied veterans who had enrolled in college and to some extent veterans who had people who had enlisted in part for college benefits. That's definitely a subset of the enlistment population of the military, which is why I can't claim to speak for all veterans, but I can look at the people that I spoke to who really did, they came back to college for different reasons. Some came because they wanted to make sense of their experience in the military and in combat and sort of understand that in a different way. Some because they wanted to build on the experience that they had gained in their military careers. You know, so if they had learned, if they had been, some had been guards in prison camps and they thought it would be a very easy jump for them to just go and become a to enter into the police academy and enter into law enforcement. So they were looking to build on their military experience, and other people were looking to completely break from that and understand what they had gone through through a different lens, through opening up their experience and learning other things than what they learned in the military. And I can't generalize with based on gender with that, but I there were, in general, I would say, fewer sort of straight line pathways of continuing military careers, maybe Secret Service or things like that, available to women. And now I don't have actual evidence for that, so I should be careful about saying that. But it seemed like there were fewer women that were really interested in just going on and building on doing a civilian version of what they did in the military. In my experience, I didn't see that as much, but I'm sure that exists somewhere.
And I think that's really interesting. And I think one of the big contributions of your book is to sort of break down this imagined idea of what a veteran looks like and what a veteran wants and what a veteran needs as they enter into institutions of academic life as opposed to military life. So I thank you for sort of bringing that complexity to the conversation. And I think today you've given our listeners a really good sense of your book and of its arguments. And I'd like to know now, just for you, you know, what was the hardest part of writing this book?
Well, honestly, the hardest part of writing it was writing it. I mean, the best part for me, I'll start out with what was most gratifying, what was most interesting and engaging for me was talking to the veterans and really learning about their experience. So to start up with what was the easiest part for me and the most gratifying was really hearing their experience. For me, that also informed my findings that I too had these ideas of what a veteran was and is and does and thinks. And to hear this diversity of opinion, diversity of worldview was so refreshing and so gratifying to really be able to talk to people and hear their own perspectives. The fact that it kind of came up against not only my own previously held myths, but also to see those myths being perpetrated in the greater society was part of my finding that we all carry these ideas of what, you know, these essentialist ideas of what veterans are, but that's not really borne out. And so the answer to that is really talking to people. You know, we need to be able to talk to people and find out what their experience actually is. So the best part about writing this book was doing the research and doing the interviews and finding that out. The hardest part was actually sitting down and trying to make these very wide-ranging interviews and wide-ranging thoughts of a diverse group of veterans, try to make a coherent narrative out of that and try to break it down so that it tells a story that is, you know, somewhat linear and understandable. So I think the hardest thing was trying to convey the stories of the veterans and put it in a context of social theory that did justice to their stories. I think that that was the hardest thing. I really was trying to be mindful of that. And I wanted to not essentialize further, because I think that was one of the problems that I was encountering, is that people felt like their own experience was essentialized and kind of instrumentalized to tell a story that wasn't theirs.
Well, and if readers take home only one thing from your book, what would you want it to be?
Well, I guess I can't just say it's one thing. I'm going to push it and ask for two things that they can, that I can ask them to take home. I think the first thing would be to try to listen to the experience of people that were developing services around and talking to, for example, listen to the experience of the veterans, ask them about their experience, try to find out without preconceived notions about what they need, try to find out what their struggles are. You know, their struggles might not be what we assume their struggles are. So engage in that dialogue. And people don't have to agree, but it's important to talk about it. So just engage in that dialogue. And the second thing I would ask that people take away from it is that the recognition that the loudest voice in the room is not always the most accurate voice in the room. And just because a message about what veterans want or who veterans are, what they need, just because that's repeated again and again, doesn't necessarily make it true. And that the way that we can really engage with this, if we really want to support people returning from the military and coming veterans, is that we can listen to them and we can develop services based on what they tell us, rather than based on perhaps what the institutional military would like us to believe, or would, you know, what there's the common sense view of what veterans need. So that would be the two things, is like listen to veterans, a way that you develop services that are not just sort of common sense ideas, is by talking to those most intimately involved in the project, that talk to the veterans. I think those would be the two messages I have.
Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me today, and I know our listeners do too. And before I go, I'd love to know, what do you think your next project will be?
Sure. Since January of 2016, I have been working in a neighborhood in Oakland, California, that has one of the highest populations of recent immigrants from Central America. They've come here for various reasons, many, most seeking asylum in the United States. So I'm doing a study, I'm researching the reasons that they come to the United States, the reason that they go through the incredible trials of getting here and the difficulties, and then what their experience is trying to settle in California in this moment of history. I started this in early 2016. Donald Trump had already begun his candidacy, and the rhetoric that was employed in the candidacy was very much had immigrants as central antagonists. And so I'm studying about what that does to populations that are coming here seeking refuge and asylum, and what that experience is like for them. So that's what I'm working on now.
Well, that sounds like another timely and important book. So thank you very much. And I will look forward to reading that one when it comes out as well.
Thank you.